For those passionate about books and reading, welcome to Read On Live at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. Coming up later, I'll be chatting to author of the year 2017, Graham McRae Burnett, about his novel The Disappearance of Adele Badeau and the Booker shortlisted and multi-award winning His Bloody Project.
I asked him, so are you okay about the book? And he's still staring at the steering wheel. I'm not unhappy. I was like, okay, I'll take that.
But first at the event, we heard from some people to whom the Talking Book Service is a lifeline. Blind author Gordon Anthony, Hazel Kelly, an RNIB volunteer and connector, and chair of RNIB Scotland, Sandra Wilson. I first asked blind author Gordon Anthony how someone with sight loss actually writes.
I use a computer with the JAWS software, and I had to learn how to touch type because I can't see the screen. The screen's off when I'm typing, and I just listen to JAWS telling me all the typing mistakes I'm making because my fingers don't operate at the same speed as my brain when I'm typing, and I make a lot of mistakes and have to delete things and start all over again.
What sort of books is it you write?
Mostly historical fiction novels, primarily set in Roman times, in Roman Britain. Adventure stories, really, but I hope with a fairly high degree of historical accuracy, because nothing annoys me more than reading a historical fiction novel with historical errors in it. That's not to say there aren't errors in my books, but hopefully only the real experts will spot them.
And it was sight loss that brought you to writing?
Yes and no. I suffer from RP, so my sight loss was quite gradual to begin with. But when it got to the stage that I could no longer really do the work I was doing, and I took early retirement, I remember my GP saying to me, "You'll have to do something to keep yourself occupied." And I'd always wanted to write. I'd tried writing books before. I actually wrote a novel some years ago, and it was awful. No, it really was awful. But I had more time. I'd also had a lot more. I'd done a lot more reading. I'd been studying history all my life, and I studied with the Open University, studying Roman history. And my wife said to me, "What are you going to do with a degree in classical history? That'll never get you anywhere." So when I had the time and I thought I'd built up enough knowledge and I had some ideas, I had lots of ideas buzzing around in my head, and I thought, it's time I just put these down in black and white. And then I had to learn how to touch type, otherwise I would have got nowhere.
Before the writer, there is the reader, so how important are accessible books?
Oh, absolutely vital. I've always been a reader. From my primary school days, when I first learned how to read, I was down at the local library taking out books all the time. Never without a book. And of course, as your sight loss develops, I moved into large print books. I'm afraid I tried Braille. I'm afraid I couldn't get the hang of it at all. So I was reading large print books. I had magnifying glasses. I had spotlights to illuminate the pages. And it was getting more and more difficult all the time. But advances in technology are fantastic. I moved into the Kindle tablets, which speak the text to you. A bit robotic, but at least it kept me going. And then when I discovered RNIB's talking books on the library, that was just fantastic. I always have a talking book on my phone, never ever without it. Some of them, you're allowed 14 days, I think, on your phone before the book disappears. Never got close to that, I don't think. Sometimes 3 or 4 days, that's that one done, on to the next one. I just love stories. I used to go to my local library and take books out on CD and so on, which was fine. But, you know, every hour or so you have to stop and change the CD, and you can't wander far from your CD player. But with the smartphones now, I mean, I can search the library because my phone talks to me as well, with the voiceover facility. Find a book, download it, and within a couple of minutes it's there and I can listen to it. And I plug in my earphones and I can wander about the house and do my chores, and I'm still listening to books and annoying the rest of the family by never answering any of their questions. You've always got your earphones in.
I was talking to an author about the difference between audiobooks and print books, and he said, well, you can't wash the dishes with a penguin in your hand.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We're also joined by Hazel Kelly. Now, Hazel, you're a volunteer with RNIB.
Yes, I certainly am. For my sins, it's her bloody project, I think, is what you could call it.
And you're also a community fundraiser for RNIB.
Yes, for Angela Preston, who is a great persuader, shall I say. I've started a community project to raise money for talking books, to raise money for one adult book and one child book, which will total £4,000. I've given myself 6 months to do it, which sounds like a long time, but, you know, people need persuaded. But I really want to involve the whole community, you know, businesses, schools. I've just newly also started a community sight loss group in Christdorfen because I know what it's like myself being in a black spot. When you hit sight loss, it came to me quite suddenly just about 2 years ago, and met a lot of nice young people from all over Scotland when I got signed up for these projects. I got sent on a workshop and I met amazing all ages, actually, but particularly the young people that had sight loss from early on, and the fact that they were so reliant on talking books and loved it made me think I need to do something about that in my community. So I thought it'd be good to have it as a community project. So actually, when I think about it, I've got two bloody projects on the go. So, yes.
Now, we mentioned your book group before we started talking on air. Were you in that book group before your sight loss?
Yes, for my sins, I started this this book group, and I've got some of my friends and members of the book group here today. And obviously, in those days, I didn't have sight loss. I've got a couple of corneal conditions, and it was kind of gradual at first, but I had to have a corneal transplant, basically to save my sight. But from the moment I had the corneal transplant, it caused a kind of distortion, and I see sort of double vision, and I just couldn't read at all. I can just about see headlines in newspapers. Besides other things, it certainly stopped me being able to read at all. I've gone for about a year with me kind of struggling to actually keep up with the group and get involved with what they are reading. And we've now decided to turn it on its head. And because I'm a member of Talking Books, and we've got the library, which I'm just was talking to the girls actually yesterday, I'll show them the library and we can jointly pick a book that we want to read that I know I can get on Talking Books, and then they can go out and either buy it or get it from the library as well. So we're going to turn it on its head so that I'm not going to be, not that they're deliberately excluding me, but you know what I mean, so that at least I can be part of what was originally my book group.
I'm also joined by Sandra Wilson. Explain what your role is.
I sometimes think of myself as the gopher. I try to promote the interests of blind and partially sighted people in Scotland wherever I can, and support RNIB Scotland, both the staff and the customers, so that we can work together to produce the best situation for blind and partially sighted people in Scotland.
And how important have Talking Books been to you?
Oh, very important. I started life as a Braille reader, and before I managed to read Braille, before I went to school, I was read to. I come from a family of readers. We haunt the library, and whenever anybody's asked to do something in the family, the reply is always, just wait till I finish my chapter. And nothing happens till the chapter's finished. So if the potatoes are boiling over, you've just got to hang on. I'm quite sure at the very end, when the curtains are closing for me and the levers being pressed, I'll be shouting out, I've only got a couple of pages to go. So I was a Braille reader for many years, and I got frustrated because there was such a lack of it. And we'd read the same book umpteen times. I was looking for a lot more. My brother, as he got older, was less persuadable. He read to me as a child, sometimes under duress. But as he got older, and he was probably reading stuff my mother might not have wanted me to be read to. And it took me a while to come to Talking Books, because I tended to think of audio as something that I used for study. Then the message got through that you could listen to books on it, proper books, not just study books, interesting books, and you could also listen to music and audio. And I became a convert to Talking Books. And I think I've been through a great many of the various machines for reading Talking Books, going from a huge thing you could hardly lift onto a table to what I use now, which is a Victor Reader Stream, where I just put the book onto the stream, stick it in my pocket, and off I go.
Now, Gordon, just what do talking books mean to you?
Well, when you can't see, there are so many things you can't do. Reading would have been one of those, and I think that's one of the things I would have missed most. But talking books mean that door has opened again. And I don't know where I'd be without them, to be honest. I just love reading, I love stories. And without talking books, I would be even more grumpy than I am now.
Yeah. Hazel, what about yourself?
Well, when I started a book, when I could read, and it was a great one, I would actually never put it down and just read right through the night. And with having talking books, you can, for me personally, it means I can have the same thing, except my husband will come through and say, your light's disturbing me, turn it off, for goodness sakes. Yeah, but I think it's because I've got grandchildren and I've now met young people that can't see and can't read, that I just think it's so important that young people have access to literature as I had when I was a child, and as my grandchildren, who fortunately are sighted, have. So I think that's mostly what it means to me.
And Sandra, what about yourself?
I've never had sight, and talking books, the first thing they did was they widened the scope of what I could get to read. Now I enjoy them because of the choice that you have, but I'm also really pleased that it means that you can converse with other people about books and talk about what they're talking about. And I'm particularly pleased to see the number of children's books that are now available in Talking Book, because I think it's very, very important that children can read.
Sandra Wilson, Gordon Anthony and Hazel Kelly, thank you so much for joining me on RNIB Connect Radio. And coming up in a moment, I'll be chatting live to author of the year 2017, Graham McRae Burnett.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Please welcome my next guest, Graham McRae Burnett. Now, Graham, you're no stranger to RNIB talking books.
No, I'm not.
Your first book, The Disappearance of Adele Badeau, was recorded there. How did that come about?
So my first book, all my books have been published by a small independent publisher called Saraban Books, until recently were based in Partick in Glasgow, and very close neighbours of Connect Radio. So I think Sarah, my publisher, had used or was regularly putting forward books for to be recorded, and so it was kind of like neighbourliness in a way. And, but I think there's a kind of ethos as well with Sarah, my publisher, and myself, to want to use people who are local. And so that was the first thing. I think we did an interview for the radio station then, and I've done a book group over the telephone for RNIB. And we did His Bloody Project up there as well. And I think as well, it's like access to actors with, you know, the right kind of accents and stuff. It's all useful, and it's good.
Now, the let's take the two books as a whole. There's a distance there.
Uh-huh.
You know, the first book isn't a book I wrote. This is a book I translated. The second book isn't a book I wrote. It's a book I found. Why is there that arm's length from the reader?
Thanks for starting with such an easy question. I did an event a couple of years ago before His Bloody Project at Shawlands Academy, and with some you know, kids of 14 or 15, and one of them asked me almost the same question. It was the first time I'd been asked, you know, why are you hiding behind these other authors? So in the first book, I pretend that I merely translated the novel, and it was the work of this French writer called Raymond Bruny. Bruny being a quite obvious pun of my own name. I mean, but strangely to me at the time, a lot of people believed that it was actually a French novel. And sometimes we were a little bit disgruntled by that as if I'd tricked them. And I started to become really interested in that, because when we read a novel, we're always tricking ourselves because we know it's a fiction. But, you know, if the novel works for us, We want to believe that it's real. It has a reality for us. We, you know, we create pictures in our heads. Or, you know, I don't know how that works. If you're visually impaired, I'd be very interested to hear about that. But anyway, I'm avoiding your question. Why do I do that? The short answer is, I don't know. You know, I've got a kind of brainy answer about Roland Barthes and the death of the author, and how I think that the important relationship is the relationship between the reader and the book, not the relationship between the author and the book. And, you know, very often, especially if you're studying books at school, the question that your teachers tend to ask you is, what did the author mean? And to me, it's the least interesting question. As a reader, I don't care what the author meant. So I want readers to have their own engagement and take their own meanings, find their own resonance with the book, and it becomes less and less relevant, you know, what the author thought. So I think there is a kind of serious, there's a kind of playfulness about it, but there's a kind of seriousness. I'm kind of saying, you know, you make up, you know, you come to your own conclusions about the book. You know, don't worry about what I thought.
That rabbit hole goes deeper, though, because
I thought this was going to be some light, fluffy event, you know.
The translator's note at the end, which is you wrote, says that it was made into a film in the 60s, and there's a trailer for that film online now.
Well, that's right. That does. As Robert said, the afterword to my first book says that it got made into a film by Claude Chabrol, and this famous French film director is a real person, and this made the book into a sort of cult hit in France. And then I was doing an event. I've got a friend in Glasgow who runs a kind of cult cinema night, so we decided we would show a Claude Chabrol film, and I would do a bit of an introduction and a reading from Adèle Baudot, because it's a very small town atmosphere, and he's a very clever guy with, you know, all these sort of techie gizmos. So he made a sort of pastiche trailer for the Claude Chabrol film that doesn't exist. And it is now, it is there online. Mm. You've obviously been doing your research. And a journalist came across it one time. It was actually David Robinson of The Scotsman. He was interviewing me. And he got very concerned that I was trying to pretend that it was something that it wasn't, or something, or I was being more than mischievous. But it's all these things that just came out of, that was a bit of fun, and it's still there. And I've become more and more interested in the questions of why people are concerned that what they're reading is not real. When it's encapsulated, there was a review on Amazon for the first book, and the reviewer seemed to have generally enjoyed the book. But he ended his review with the words, "It's a shame it's all so fake." I'm like, well, yeah, it's a novel. But what he felt was like, the novel was not as it appeared. It was not a real novel. It's a fake novel that is made up. But of course, all novels are fake and made up. And I don't have an answer to all these things. But as you say, it's a kind of rabbit hole, and it all gets racked up with his bloody project, where I claim to have found the documents. Mm. I describe the documents in Anne O'Hanlon in the archive, who helped me. She doesn't exist. The documents don't exist. And then I found this real-life character, James Bruce Thompson, the psychiatrist in the book. He is a real person, and he enters my fictional world. So I'll leave it to you to untangle it.
We'll get to his bloody project in a moment, but first of all, an easy one. Tell us about the disappearance of Adèle Baudot.
It's really nice to be asked about it, because I rarely am these days. It's a book. It's set in this small town in France called Saint-Louis, which I visited quite by chance. It's a very unremarkable place, and it's described as an unremarkable place. It's right on the border with Switzerland. And the book came about because I wandered into this town for absolutely no reason whatsoever with a friend. And we went for lunch in a very typical French brasserie, the sort of place where there's a menu du jour. And everybody, the clerical workers, come in for their three-course lunch and a glass of wine. The guys from the building site come in for their three-course lunch. And, you know, the bank manager will be in. And everybody stops and has lunch, and I love that. And these places, there's a sense of timelessness about these places, and there's a great sense of routine that people go there every day. And I was sitting there having my lunch. This was about nearly 16 years ago. And so you can see how rapid a writer I am. And there was a character standing at the counter, and he was wearing a suit, and he looked a bit sort of uncomfortable. And there was some men at the in the table in the corner who seemed more sort of jovial and cheery and enjoying each other's company. And I suppose it's the sort of writerly imagination. I suddenly saw these characters as being people who appeared and came to that restaurant every day for lunch but never spoke to each other, or there would be some unspoken dislike between them. And I wrote a little sketch at the time, just a description of the restaurant and the characters there. And it was 10 or more years later, I came back to that sketch. It just lodged in my head. And I just used that to sort of create the story and allow the characters to... I put an event in, the disappearance of Adele Bedeau, who's a waitress in the brasserie. And she disappears, and that event is just a trigger for everything else that happens in the book. So it's really a character study of this guy that I saw standing at the counter, sort of ill at ease outsider called Manfred Baumann.
We experience the book almost through his mind and
absolutely
Gorski as well, the police officer.
I mean, I'm most interested. I mean, in both books, what I'm most interested in is character and the motivations of the character. Manfred Baumann is a very obsessive, sort of paranoid character, so he's continually, we're inside his head, so it's quite claustrophobic, the sort of ridiculous thoughts he has. One early on in the book, because he goes there every day for lunch, he changes his lunch order. And this is a momentous event, you know, for Manfred Baumann. And he imagines that in the kitchen, they'll all be proclaiming, Manfred Baumann has changed his order! But of course, nobody notices, nobody cares. This is all the machinations that go through Manfred's head, and he behaves like that in relation to everything. He overthinks everything. And basically, Manfred is just an exaggerated version of myself. So it was quite easy for me to write. I had to actually tone it down because I was like, nobody's going to believe that somebody could be so petty. And that's just the me.
Gorski is certainly going to come back.
So, yeah, Gorski is the chief of police in this small town, and he's not a very effective, although there's a detective in the novel, there's not actually a lot of detective work goes on. In fact, I actually wrote about 50 pages where he started doing normal investigating stuff that cops on TV do, and I just threw it all in the bin because I just felt, I've read this before, it didn't feel interesting to me. But because what I was interested in was the character of Gorski and why he's interested in this case and the relationship between the two characters. So all that kind of stuff, just, you know, move on. You can all imagine that it happened. So Gorski returns in my new book, The Accident on the A35, which will be out on October the 26th. If you're based in Edinburgh, there's going to be a launch in Waterstones and Princes Street on the 1st of November with my friend Lucy Ribchester. Plug, plug, plug. So Gorski comes back in this book, and he's more the central character in this book.
And it's not the road to Dorchester to Bournemouth.
It's not. And everybody is saying, is that the road from here to there? Or, yeah, the A35 runs from Strasbourg in the north to Basel or Baal, which is right next to Saint-Louis on the Swiss border. So the story behind the book, because I'm now writing, especially with this book, I was writing in the character of Raymond Bruni, my fictional author. And the accident on the A35, if you read The Disappearance of Adele Bedeau very, very carefully, you'll know that the fictional author, Raymond Bruni's father, was killed in an accident on the A35. So this is now Raymond Bruni writing a fictionalized account of that real event in his life. But what was a bit, made me a bit uneasy, I went back to the town of Mulhouse, which is next to Saint-Louis, to do some research. And I'd been to Saint-Louis twice, and both times in the middle of winter. And it's quite a drab place. And in the winter in France, the skies are grey. It can be really cold around there. So it just seemed like a really miserable place. And I write about the town in a quite... I'm quite rude about the town. and which is that's a horrible thing to do, but yeah, so there you go. Bizarrely, it's now going to be published in French. So the translator is now translating my fake translation back into the original language. But anyway, I went back this time for the new book to San Luis, and I went. It was June or May or June. It was 30 degrees. The blossom was out on all the trees, and I was like, "Oh no, San Luis is actually quite nice." I was like, "All right, I'm going to have to make it nicer in the new book. You know, I can't be so rude." But then I realized, hold on. It's Raymond Bruni that's writing this book. And Raymond Bruni, in the sort of story of Raymond Bruni, is trapped in the town. He hates San Luis because he always wanted to go elsewhere, but he never could. Or he could never bring himself to leave. So I have to be even ruder about the town in the new book because he's more bitter. So I can't go back again.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
And now a return to Read On Air, recorded live at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. I'm in conversation with Graham McCrae-Burnett.
Now, his bloody project, where did that come from?
There was kind of two inspirations for the book. One was, and again, it's like a huge long germination of an idea. When I was a student at Glasgow University nearly 30 years ago, I came across a book about a French peasant called Pierre Rivière. And Pierre Rivière killed three members of his own family with some agricultural tools, I believe, which, of course, is quite interesting. But what was really fascinating about it was he wrote a memoir from his prison cell about the events leading up to the murders. And it's a really beautifully written document. And that completely fascinated me, just that somebody... allegedly not particularly highly educated, a peasant who'd committed this act of tremendous violence could then write a eloquent account about what he'd done. So that was the kind of germ of the idea for His Bloody Project. If you don't know, His Bloody Project tells the story of a triple murder in a small village in the north of Scotland carried out by a crofter who then writes an eloquent account of what he's done or the events leading up to the murder. So that was the germ of the idea. Mm. And my family background on my mother's side is from Wester Ross, so it's an area of the country that I know pretty well. So it just seemed that it felt quite natural for me to set my version of this in that part of the country. I mean, and once you start writing, I mean, I was talking about historical writing a little earlier. Once you start writing, the novel takes on a life of its own, or it has to take on a life of its own. So even although there's a germ of an idea that is the beginning, it becomes something that you don't necessarily know what it is at the beginning of the process.
Well, and no doubt they committed the crime, but it's more what the state of his mind was when he committed it.
I think the two big questions for the reader, which I never give you the answers to because... I want the reader to engage with the book and come to their own view of what happened. So, was Roddy McCrae insane at the time that he committed these acts? And what was his motivation? Because although we have his account, which is 150 pages of the book, about half the book, we come to doubt the truth of some of the things he's told us, or we feel that he may have omitted some important information about the details of his crimes. And then we have other views. We have the view of the psychiatrist. There's the court scenes where the legal world sort of comes to have a say. So, but yeah, that's the big question of the book: was he mad or not?
I'll ask you that off mic in case anybody hasn't read the book and wants to read it. I'm very aware of giving out spoilers.
Uh-huh.
Has anyone from Kildooey read it?
Oh God, yeah.
Back to you, yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. The whole village. I mean, Kildooey is a real place, and it's a place. I think there are 10 or 11 houses there, so it's a very small place. And the neighbouring village of Applecross, which is a lot of tourists go to Applecross. But even the road to Kildooey is a dead end, and even Kildooey is set back from that road. So it's not a place where people visit. You couldn't happen into Kildooey. As far as I know, certainly in Applecross, people seem highly delighted by the whole thing, and I'm always very welcome in the Applecross Inn. I go back frequently. I was aware of the kind of weight of responsibility about writing about such a small place, and I have made an effort. I've done book groups up there, and I did an event in the neighbouring village, and I'll be up there again. And I always, talk to people in the bar. But it's been overwhelmingly positive. I think with the village of Kildooey, I think there may be one person who's not so happy about it. There's an old guy who lives at the end. He's called Mr. Murchison, and he's still a crofter, and he's very much your Westeros, old boy. And I was up there, and he stopped his car. I was doing an interview overlooking Kildooey, and he just stopped his car. It was a bashed-up old Citroen Berlingo, with a couple of sheep in the back. And he didn't say anything. He just sat there in his car, staring at his steering wheel. And I kind of went over to him and, said, "Oh, hi, how you doing?" And he obviously knew what was going on. And the interviewer spoke to him in Gaelic and sort of introduced me. I'd recognized him because I'd been in the village. And I was like, I asked him, "So are you okay about the book?" And he's still staring at the steering wheel. "I'm not unhappy." Yeah. I was like, "Okay, I'll take that." All right, see you.
Now, the one real character in the book, J. Bruce uh-huh. Thompson, wrote Travels in the Borderlands of Lunacy. Did
yes.
documents like that actually exist in that way of speaking to the lower classes?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so James Bruce Thompson was the resident surgeon at the General Prison for Scotland at the time, and this was where... So he was a real character. And this was where Scotland's criminally insane were housed. So if you were found to be insane in the commission of a crime, you were sent to James Bruce Thompson's prison. And he used his population, I suppose he kind of studied them. And he wrote two articles, one called The Psychology of Criminals and one called The Hereditary Nature of Crime. And in particular, the latter one, The Hereditary Nature of Crime, is a very sort of Darwinian sort of thesis about how there is a criminal class and they are interbred, and they are so interbred that the negative characteristics are reproduced among them, and they actually have no free will, and so they commit crimes, but they are unable to prevent themselves committing crimes. It's a very disturbing piece of work. And so he sees this criminal class, as he calls it, as a sort of almost as subhumans, and he talks about, what's the word for preventing people from procreating. So it's very disturbing stuff, and he's got this tremendously arrogant, pompous way of expressing himself. So these articles actually exist, and fantastic find for a novelist, because I could then introduce him into my book. And so he examines Roddy McRae in prison, almost as if he's a piece of livestock, at a cattle market, describing the shape of his skull and his deep-set eyes and so on. And he also goes on a trip to Kildooey, which just provides me with the opportunity to be rude about the local the local people through his voice. But people, visitors, even as quite late into the 19th century, when sort of the beginnings of tourism, which is kind of a Victorian invention, and people would write these accounts of traveling to the tremendously poverty-stricken areas. And they would describe the houses as being like a smoking dung heap, not fit for human habitation. Mm. And they did write, but the conditions were very, 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 very bad. And people did live in black houses without chimneys, with the livestock in the same house. So, for these Victorian aristocrats to travel from Edinburgh, you know, which, you know, the Scottish Enlightenment had happened. Edinburgh was a seat of European philosophy, a wealthy city. To travel a relatively short distance to this great poverty, you know, it must have been very shocking. But they did write about it, and in a way, it's almost comic the way the arrogance with which they dismissed these barbarians, you know, and the Gaelic language dismissed as a sort of barbarian tongue. Mm. Still is by some people.
Now, the book's published by a wee local publisher, and then suddenly Man Booker get involved.
Yeah, Man Booker. yeah, I mean, at this time, well, that happened in the end of July last year, so almost exactly a year ago. I'd published two novels, and the glamour of that life meant that I was earning most of my money at the time as a painter and decorator. And when I got the call from a publisher, I was actually painting a lady's toilet in an office in Kilmarnock. And my first reaction on hearing this quite big news was, I really need to get a second coat on that ceiling today. But Sarah was quite adamant that I had to hightail it back to Glasgow. And 20 minutes later, I was speaking to the literary editor of The Guardian, who doesn't normally return my calls. And 20 minutes after that, there's my comments on you know, the Guardian's website. I mean, it was the obviously the long list. There's 13 books, and any journalist, maybe some journalists in the room, it's probably a bit of a nightmare. It's like, we need a story about the Booker long list, and it's 13 books you've never heard of, probably. But we got a lot of coverage because of the story of it coming from such a small publisher, and you know, all that stuff was true. I mean, it's a small publisher, but it's a very good publisher. It's a very professional publisher. Sarah Hunt, who Robert knows, is, you know, she's a force of nature. You know, she's brilliantly enthusiastic about all the books she publishes. She's very passionate. She cares about her writers as people as well. Well, she cares about me anyway. I don't know about the other ones. So that was a great story for the press. And obviously, the kind of, is it a crime novel on the Man Booker list? That was also a story. I mean, and the reach of that prize is totally global. I mean, on that day, we were getting calls from, you know, publishers in Japan, because it's unusual that, you know, a book comes from such... I mean, I think there's a couple of books every year. You know, that happens for. So you're not already signed up to foreign publishers. So it's just quite mind blowing. You're inside this sort of vortex. It's good though. Yeah.
You know, the initial run of the book sold out in about 6 seconds after it was long listed.
Yeah, because I think there was no advanced notification that it would be on the long list. And I think at that point, 1,500 copies of the book had been printed. So there probably was only a few hundred available. So there was a kind of little hiatus of 3 days where nobody could get their hands on it. And I was like, it's so frustrating. You know, it's your big moment. Nobody can buy the book. But it was just inevitable, you know. But, you know, on Amazon that day, His Bloody Project, I think it leapt from something like 200,000 to number 9. Number 9 on, you know, on the general list. It was just like, wow.
And that's just the long list. That's
not
that
was
the
long
list. Then it was shortlisted and that doubled almost.
Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah, you get invited to all these lovely swanky events and, you know, that's the profile of the book has increased further. You know, I mean, I'm always enjoy talking about this because it's such an extraordinary thing, but I don't want 5 years from now to be, oh, that was the guy who was on the, you know, Booker shortlist once. I'll be sitting in a corner of the pub dribbling or something. you know, I want to use that as a platform. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to be honest, I think the book has already outlived. It needed that lift that the Booker Prize gave it. But it's still, I mean, we had the event just a couple of days ago, this exploration, you know, at the book festival with some actors. The book still has life. It's still selling. It needed to be brought to people's attention because nobody knew it existed before. And that's a great thing about, you know, literary prizes. I just mention, while we're talking about the Booker Prize, I got an email this morning from one of the people in the Booker Foundation, and they do actually, although it's known for the prize, they also do work in prisons and bring writers into prisons and try to get, you know, young people in prison reading. She also pointed out that they make sure that all the books that get shortlisted are available in Braille editions. So,
If it's longlisted, it's available in giant print and Braille, and then the shortlist audio versions are made initially on top of that as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, thanks to the Man Booker Prize, and they've been doing that for 4 years. That's a long-standing agreement. Now, does anyone in the audience have a question?
I was interested in where you got the religious background in the village from, because I'm not an expert in that, but it just rang true, I have to tell you, and you can judge I'm from the Highlands.
Yeah, yes. Well, actually, thanks for that question. There's a minister in the novel called Reverend Galbraith. I didn't want to write a sort of novel satirising the religious attitudes that were around at the time. Not because I'm particularly sympathetic towards them, but because it felt like too easy a target, because the role of the Church of Scotland during the clearances was not, I don't think they covered themselves in glory. So I wanted to give a fair representation. You can't really write a novel set there without having a minister. He's a figure of authority. And I came across in my grandmother's house, I mentioned that, which we still have, it's full of old religious books. And there was a book, it's the sermons of the Reverend Angus Galbraith, who a bit earlier in the 19th century was a well-known minister on Rassy, which is the island very close to there. So this book of his sermons, you know, I read through it, and this kind of speech that Reverend Galbraith gives at Roddy's mother's funeral is taken almost verbatim from that book. It is credited in the acknowledgements of the book. But yeah, because I didn't feel... That's a really difficult thing. I'm not a religious person. I didn't feel capable of, you know, making that stuff up. So I just took it very much from that authentic piece of work, and that's probably why it seemed to ring true for you.
Thank you. Was there a temptation after the success to have your next book return to that era?
No. I think, again, this goes to my relationship with my publisher, who, you know, after my first book set in France, she said, "Oh, are you working on anything else?" And I'm like, "I'm writing a novel set in 19th century Scotland." And a lot of publishers would be like, "Oh, no, you're not. You're going to write another book set in France with the same detective, and then another one and another one." They want you to repeat what you've done before. Whereas Sarah was like, "That sounds great. You know, look forward to seeing it." I do feel it's odd, you know, because obviously a lot more people are going to come to my new book than have done before, and they may expect another 19th century historical Scottish book. Tough. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm in a fortunate position now, and I want to remain true to what I want to write, and I think writing a novel is a terrible long slog, and if you don't kind of have a kind of passion for what you're doing, if you feel you're doing it to fulfill a contractual obligation or something like that, or to fulfill other people's expectations, I think you're beginning to be on a bit of a sticky wicket. And I just want to write what I want to write, and hopefully it finds an audience.
You mentioned in your first novel that you based the characters on a sketch you'd jotted down 10 years earlier in a French brasserie. Why did it take you 10 years to revisit them? And what were you doing in between time, apart from painting and decorating?
That's a good question. Ian Rankin, I heard him say once, if somebody says it took them 10 years to write a novel, they were in the pub for 9 years. I worked in television at the time. I was a kind of researcher for documentaries, so I had a pretty much full-time job. But I also started like 3 other novels, and wrote them to about 20 or 30,000 words, and I just sort of hit a kind of wall with them. And then I lost my job in television. Like many people, all I had ever wanted to do in my life was to publish a novel, you know. And when I said to my girlfriend the day after Sarah agreed to publish it, "I will die happy now," you know, which is true, you know. So I'd had these various false starts, and the fact that I even remembered that scene, and it stuck in my head, said something, and I just went back to it, and I kind of played a trick on myself. I said, "Don't pretend you're not writing a novel. It's just a short story," and it grew and grew, and it became sort of 30,000 words, and then it was 50,000 words, and I developed it like that. It took me a long time to write it because it was quite a difficult writing process, and when you're not published, it's very difficult to retain confidence in what you're doing. I mean, maybe you're a writer yourself, and you might know that. But I think I was just sort of entranced by that scene, and I went back to it without no plan whatsoever of what would occur in the novel, only these characters and this event that kind of has this big impact on them. So yeah, it's a funny process, you know. And again, with His Bloody Project, just something that had stuck in my head for 30 years, you know, I came back to it. I mean, I've got a book that I'm going to write after. I'm going to write one now, then I'm going to write the third of the trilogy of the French books, and then I'm going to write something which I had the idea for when I was a student. I'm going backwards. I've never grown up, that's another thing.
Now, mentioning research, His Bloody Project and the Delbert O'Rourke character-driven stories, but is it important to know what Rory was wearing and what he was eating? And
it's kind of important. I'm not the sort of writer who makes sketches of the characters, what they had for breakfast and so on. The thing, when you're writing in the first person, you have to be absolutely 100% true to what the character would say. So it's actually quite difficult to, you know, describe things for the reader, because Roddy's not going to describe it, because to him it's just the normal background of his life. He's not going to talk about the beautiful mountains and the spectacular landscape, because it's like Soggy Hall Street to him. Mm-hmm. I think for me, it's not a book about the sort of sweep of history. It's a book about the minutiae of people's lives. So it was kind of important to know what they ate and things like that. You know, oatcakes and potatoes and more oatcakes, another potato. That was pretty much it. I think novels to me are about the minutiae of life rather than the sweep of history, or that's what I enjoy reading about. I like character. I like to feel that I'm immersed in a sense of place in the novel. And these kind of things are much more difficult to find out about than the big historical things.
Any more questions?
I think it was E.M. Forster who said that an important aspect of a novel was, do you mind what happens to the characters? Now, you've mentioned you like the reader to make up his or her own mind.
Yes.
About a character. But as an author, do you mind what happens to them?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. I cry real tears. No, seriously. If I don't care, you won't care. Uh-huh. And I go to the Mitchell Library in Glasgow to work because I'm so easily distracted. And I, if I'm getting a certain way through the book and I haven't felt moved by what I'm writing, then I think it's really, really important. I mean, when I was writing the end of His Bloody Project, I had tears streaming down my face. And you know, I mean, when I was writing Adèle Badeau, which in some ways is not such a dark book, it's not exactly, you know, happy clappy. But there's a silly, or not silly scene, a rather comic scene where Gorski's wife owns a boutique, a sort of fashion boutique, and she likes to sell clothes which are a bit too high class for her clientele. And she has a little fashion show every year using the local schoolgirls to parade around the shop. And on the night of this event, the show goes really well, and Celine is really happy with how it's gone. And when I was writing that, I was just tremendously moved by it. I was so happy for her. And Celine's a character who gets a really hard time in the book. I love her, you know. And I think you have to feel that kind of engagement with the characters. And you hope that that translates into the reader having the same engagement. So, yeah, I totally care. That's why they all have such happy endings.
If you're crying real tears, there must be a part of you thinks, this doesn't need to happen.
How do you mean?
I can change that. I don't
know. No, you can't change it. You can't change it because you're following the logic of your narrative. You're following through how the characters have interacted with the events of the novel. And, you know, it's quite a mysterious, and it can sound a little bit pretentious, but it's actually true for me as a writer that I don't know what's going to happen. Mm. Even as I was writing the trial, the last section of His Bloody Project, and at a certain point, there's a terrible blow to Roddy's case, and I was like, oh, damn. And then I went to the library the next morning, and Roddy's lawyer, Mr. Sinclair, gets up and he makes this rousing speech. And I'm like, come on, Mr. Sinclair, that's it. And it's like, I was, you know, I'm following the process through. And a very important word for me in writing and the kind of stuff I like is inevitability. I want the ending of the novel to feel that it could not be any other way, even although we may wish it to be so. So you're following the inexorable logic of what you've written previously, and the beginning feeds into the middle and the middle feeds into the end. So yeah, of course I could change it, but that wouldn't feel like an authentic writing process. In the new book, Gorski, my cop, there's a kind of subplot about a crime that's taken place sort of off stage. And at a certain point, Gorski, you're going to have to close your ears if you don't want to know. I'm not going to tell you exactly what happens, but Gorski solves this crime. And I had absolutely no idea who did it until Gorski did. I mean, I'm absolutely not joking. And it's not like a whodunit. There's not like loads of characters. And it wasn't even going to be part of the story that this crime was solved, because it was a subplot. It didn't matter. It doesn't matter. Gorski solved this crime on his own. It's weird. I know, it's really hard to believe.
It's an amazing ability, being able to surprise yourself.
Yeah. Well, the way that happened was that certain things have happened, and then I'm coming to write the next chapter. I'm thinking, I'm trying to be inside Gorski's head. I'm like, what is Gorski thinking about this? So then I'm thinking trying to think Gorski's thoughts, and then Gorski goes, hold on. So yeah, it's almost like a sort of method acting kind of thing, you know. You must think I'm absolutely mad, sitting in the library, being other people, crying. I cry like once a year. Let's not exaggerate that.
I was just going to say, with so many so-called Scottish authors having their books made into films, how do you feel about potentially that happening with your books? Besides, take out the money scenario, but just actually, how do you feel about your babies being made into films?
Yeah, well, that's right. They are my babies. And previously, because we actually sold the film option before any of the book or sort of malarkey. And at that time, I was like, bring it on, because the book needed some sort of something to bring it to a wider readership. But even at that time, there's an ambivalence about it, because when somebody reads your book or listens to the audiobook, you want them to have their own sort of picture of the characters. It's kind of not it's not mediated by a visual medium. And when you watch a film or a television series, your view of what Roddy McRae is like is blown away, but in the very first frame of the film. And
it's different.
If you watch a film first, you always have that picture in your mind. So it becomes more difficult to have your own engagement with the book, which is what I want readers to have. So, yeah, there's an ambivalence to it. But on the other hand as well, I mean, we just did this kind of little theatrical exploration over the weekend. We're working with three actors and a director. And it was that was an amazing experience for me, seeing the actors and the director and another writer come to the work and do something a little bit different with it. It was just a few scenes from the book. A theatre production would really, really excite me, because, yeah, I love the theatre, but also it's transient. I don't think it fixes things so concretely in people's minds as a film does. But, yeah, it might bring me a few quid, so that would be nice too.
Thank you.
By way of adaptation as well, that kind of goes for the talking book as well. How did you feel when you heard that?
Well, it's funny because I've read quite often from His Bloody Project, and you know, I'm writing this at the behest of my advocate, Mr. Andrew Sinclair, who, since my incarceration here in Inverness, has treated me with a degree of civility I know we deserve, and so on and so on and so on. And I know it by heart. And I have my own way of emphasizing each of these sentences. So, but then an actor, the act of reading out is an act of interpretation as well. Mm. And you're like, you can't sit there going, oh, no, that's wrong. I'm writing this, you know. It's an interpretation. It's a little bit disconcerting. But to be honest, I don't ever reread my own work, and I haven't listened to the audiobooks in entirety because I think the voices that were chosen were great, you know, especially Roddy's. He had a nice tone, youthful. But yeah, no, it's funny. It's weird. It's sort of weird.
One last question.
In terms of character development, how do you feel about human error playing into your characters?
My characters are human errors. I don't think there'd be any novel that features a character who isn't flawed, or maybe in very sort of popular literature, you know, in a romance novel, the handsome doctor walked into the room. But I think in real literature with sort of three-dimensional characters, the flaws of the characters are absolutely important. So Manfred Baumann, my flawed protagonist of my first book, you know, he's this overthinking and ill at ease in society. These are the things which cause him all his problems. So when the policeman comes to ask him if he was involved in the murder, there's no murder. She disappears. He comes to ask if Manfred has seen Adele on the night she disappeared. And he lies. He did see her, but he lies about it. And because he doesn't want to be involved because he's ill at ease. So that human flaw that he has, and that, of course, leads him to fall under suspicion. And that's what I mean about one event in the novel. The character's characteristic or flaw determines how he behaves in that scene. And then because he does that, the subsequent scenes flow from that. So, yeah, absolutely. Who's interested in a goody two-shoes?
How important is it that your books are accessible?
It's totally important. I think, on the one hand, it's just a normal writerly thing. As a writer, you want your books to be accessible. You want people to be able to buy, read, borrow them, steal them. And that goes. You don't want your book not to be available to people who have some kind of visual impairment. And that, you know, it just feels unfair. But of course, you want your books to be accessible in as many forms as possible, absolutely.
Graham McRae-Burnett, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Robert.
Thanks to Man Booker PLC, the Edinburgh International Book Festival, and everyone at RNIB Scotland. Read On Air will be back with Fred Sale at the same time next week.